Join me, Rick Howe, on Island Music for the finest in ska, rocksteady, roots reggae, dub and sizzling dancehall, and all the hottest releases from around the Pacific.
Hi, I'm Ronnie Kareni from Sorong Samurai, and you're listening to Island Music.
Hi everyone, my name is Tieni from Te Tangi o Te Kara, and you're listening to Island Music.
Search up ABC Island Music to listen online or find it on the ABC Listen app.
This is an ABC podcast.
Ia koe ka salelie, whakaravalahi atu, and good morning, this is Pacific Beat on ABC Radio Australia. Coming up, Fiji's Prime Minister announces plans to appeal the High Court's damning critique of the inquiry set up to investigate the head of the country's anti-corruption watchdog.
I'm appealing the part that imply my activities and that touch on my name and what I had done.
Also, the inaugural meeting of the Australian chapter of the International Parliamentarians for West Papua was held in Canberra this week. And later in the show, American Samoa shocked everyone at the Men's Flag Football World Championship, ending America's 14-year victory streak.
You know, after we beat the USA, we were inundated by so many other countries congratulating us and thanking us because it inspired them.
All those stories and more shortly. I'm your host, Aggie Dubowa, and our show comes to you from the lands of the Bunurong and Wurundjeri peoples of the Kulin Nation. Again, appreciate your company and tuning into Pacific Beat, yours in the Pacific. Firstly, Vanuatu's Prime Minister says his government will set up an advisory committee to help the President exercise his constitutional power of mercy after inmates convicted of sexually abusing children received presidential pardons. Last week, Jotham Napat met President Negenege Vurumbaravu and asked him to revoke the pardons, but the President has refused and later issued a lengthy statement attempting to justify his decision. But that has not quelled the public backlash, and Mr. Napat now says the government will enact a constitutional provision to set up an advisory committee to guide the president's future decisions. Government spokesman Kiri Manasa tells reporter Lily Rose Welwell the aim is to have the committee in place by the end of the year.
The Prime Minister felt that it was important to make it clear that the government is not fully aligned with what the head of state has done and has basically tried to reassure the public that the government is not going to let it go. Article 38 of the Constitution makes it very clear that the Parliament may make provision for an advisory committee. Since then, nothing has been done. So pardoning decisions of the past have often been proactive, basically left only to the head of state to make. So the provision is there. So the government, basically the government, is that it will now proceed with those setting out the framework whereby an advisory committee will have to be set up to help the head of state make its decisions when it comes to especially pardoning and especially people who are convicted by the courts and found to be guilty of rape. They should be treated carefully and shouldn't be just allowed to go free without any further action or without any consideration of the victims.
So the government is going to work on a framework, and is that going to happen at the end of the year, or when is the time frame?
The current timeline is by the end of the year, we should have a proper mechanism whereby such decisions could be, given over to another committee to scrutinize before the head of state exercises his power. And I think it's very important to make it clear that some people might feel that this is like an interference in the work or the role of the head of state. The powers of the head of state are not in any way under question here. That's his prerogative. The Constitution provides for that. What the government feels is important is because of the provision, Article 38 makes provision for the establishment of an advice, really it's important that such an advice is put in place so that they can provide criteria to guide the office of the head of state.
How sure are we that the advisory body set up will be a body that the president can listen to the recommendation, as this is the second time that the issue has happened and people are raising complaint over it on social media and everywhere?
We're pretty confident that a mechanism will help guide the office of the head of state. With the public uproar from on social media in particular, it shows that I think the office of the head of state is sort of exposed in the sense that has no recourse to lean back on an organization or a body or an agency that's it's working with. So that's basically what the government is trying to do to protect the office. Because we have the Nikki Nika being the head of state. It could be anyone in future. So in order for that office and its integrity to be maintained as a symbol of peace, it is important that the government does its part to ensure that the office is well protected against what we have seen over the past few days in relation to the pardoning and the exercise of that power.
And that there is Vanuatu government spokesman Kerry Manasa speaking to Lily Rose Wellwell. Right, to Fiji's Prime Minister Sitiveni Rampuka, he says he will appeal parts of the High Court's damning critique of the Commission of Inquiry he set up to investigate the appointment of the head of the country's anti-corruption watchdog. Mr. Rampuka ordered the inquiry in 2024 after Barbara Malimali was arrested by her own staff on her first day on the job as head of the Fiji Independent Commission Against Corruption. Last Friday, the High Court declared the Commission of Inquiry's report to be null and void and quashed its findings and recommendations. The court declared the Commissioner, Australian Judge Justice David Ashton Lewis, denied Ms. Malimali and others natural justice. His adverse findings were irrational and his conduct gave rise to a reasonable apprehension of bias. It also declared the Prime Minister and the President failed to observe the requirements of procedural fairness when they released the inquiry's report to the public without notifying those adversely named within it, thereby denying them natural justice. Despite the court's strong rebuke, Mr. Rampuka told Fiji Village he did nothing wrong.
I'm appealing the part that imply my activities and touch on my name and what I had done, not on the whole thing. That depends on what my lawyers will tell me. As I'm not the author of the COI. I made the recommendation, and it's up to Attorney General when he advises me and Solicitor General. My advice went to the President. The COI report went to the President and the recommendations. The recommendations were given back to me. I gave those to the people who are empowered to make charges. That is when they would have the right to defend themselves before they took them to court. I have no right to give any right to respond to anybody. I was not investigating anyone.
And that is Fiji's Prime Minister, Sitiveni Rampuka. Good morning. Welcome back to Pacific Beat. We head to Papua New Guinea, where another foreign officer has taken up a senior leadership role in the police force, this time an officer originally from Tonga. George Whanamanu spent about 40 years with New Zealand Police before moving to PNG, where he's now the provincial policing commander in New Ireland. Commissioner David Manning says 8 Commonwealth officers have now joined the force, and he says they bring an unbiased approach to policing, and several provincial governments are asking for more. Despite never have been to PNG before, Chief Superintendent Whanamanu says he was drawn to the opportunity.
I was born in Tonga. I was 6 when my family moved to New Zealand. We settled in Auckland, so my schooling and my career and work have all been in New Zealand. I joined the police a while ago, probably 40 years ago now. How I got to this stage? I've done due deployment with the New Zealand Police into the Pacific. One was to Tonga, actually. And then I was fortunate enough to get another second deployment to Solomon Island. And that was very recent. And that's where I actually resigned from the New Zealand Police. I really enjoyed the time in the Pacific, and I really enjoyed it. I guess I yearned for something different. I had the opportunity to see what was here, and through those opportunities, I put my name forward and fortunately get selected to come here. One of those, the person that put me on this was a Czech colleague, current colleague that's here now is a BBC, but I work with her in Tonga. She ran the Australian Federal Police team there, and I looked after the Tonga police team.
Are you talking about East New Britain's PPC, Amanda Cates?
Yes, she was fantastic.
Well, now you'll be in neighbouring provinces, right?
100%. We've just been texting each other, congratulating each other. Obviously, she's been here longer than I have. But she was a bit of a mentor for me back then. You're talking 2012 here, and I walked into a role in Tonga where my predecessor had left quite early, and I was finding my feet, but she directed me. She developed my understanding of what those roles entails, and she made sure I didn't step on any landmines and get myself sent home early. She was excellent. So I owed her that. And she reached out about these roles, and I was sitting in the Solomons thinking about, I really don't want to go hunting in some winter. And to be honest, if it wasn't her, I probably wouldn't have taken the role. But because I had faith and trust in what she told me and discussed with me, it sort of made my decision easier as well. But I always wanted to do this. Look, it's a big undertaking. Walk away from the New Zealand place and travel somewhere I've never been before. Albeit I've been in Melanesia, being in the Solomon. Papua New Guinea is a bigger beast and totally different.
Police Commissioner David Manning has been very hands-on with the program you're a part of, getting foreign officers into leadership positions in the PNG police. When he brought you on, did he say what areas he wants you to focus on?
I think the biggest thing he really wanted to make sure was that connection between the police and its people. New Ireland is that sort of, it's a real community-based kind of policing. It's where you really need to work with your community. And that's what he really wants to do, is encourage this connection. And that's probably the biggest thing he emphasized to me was, when you go there, be yourself. Make sure you do think they are sustainable. He wants honesty in what I do. And other thing on top of this, obviously, with elections next year, ensuring that goes fine and it's fair and people maintain law and order and go through that process as well. That can be challenging.
As a foreign officer coming in, what can you bring to this role, do you think, that a local officer can't really?
Working across different jurisdictions does help a little bit. You know, you're understanding the process, understanding when things happen. One of the biggest things sometimes we used to get is when deaths happen or disaster, how do you relate that to jurisdictions or people from other places? I will have some understanding, because I've dealt with that previous roles or my previous occupations. But I'm sure there'll be things that I'll learn from the staff I have here, because there's things here I don't know. I'm excited about what's here. I'm obviously a little bit nervous for what's here. Just don't want to have any regrets when I hang up everything and decide to sit under that chair in the sunshine and watch the days go by.
And that there is New Ireland's new policing commander, George Whanamanu, speaking with our reporter, Natasha Emick. Pacific Beat. All right, we're staying in Papua New Guinea, where the Catholic Diocese of Bougainville ended a week-long celebration to mark the churches on 7th of August 1901. The first missionaries of the Maris Order established their base at Tubiana near Puk Puk 125 years ago. Catholics from South, Central and North Bougainville prepared for this major event over many months, with women leading the celebration. Church leaders from the Vatican, Bougainville and PNG took part in the festivities. Raymond Griana is the Media and Communications Officer with the Bougainville Women's Federation, and he is speaking here with Caroline Turman about the celebrations.
Tubiana is like the first Maris missionaries arrived and said the first mass at the island of Puk Puk. That was on the 7th of August 1901. So that 7th of August is being referred to as the foundation day for the Catholic Church in Bougainville. So the celebrations began actually at Buin in South Bougainville. And then on the foundation day, that is on the 7th of August, the celebrations was held at Tubiana, Central Bougainville. So from Central, we also had the celebrations in North Bougainville at Ahahila. And this is where our bishop currently resides.
The people who celebrated the Mass, were they all from Bougainville, or were there other visitors as well from Papua New Guinea and nearby Solomon Islands?
Oh, yes. We had visitors, like all the way from Rome, and there was a cardinal, also the nuncio, and we also had bishops and archbishops from other dioceses throughout Papua New Guinea. They were also part of the celebrations.
Could you give us a picture of what actually happened apart from the celebrations that took place? Were there traditional dancing and other activities like that?
Oh, yes. There were many activities actually that happened all throughout the region. We had these traditional dances, plus all kinds of activities that blends with our culture to showcase the faith. So the people in Bougainville, one thing good about Bougainvilleans is that we very much like to blend this cultural activities, and it was really a colorful week. You can say it was also a colorful month, whereby our people had to showcase their faith through many different ways, and through these cultural activities and dances, it was one of the ways they were able to like express and showcase, show how they were happy and to celebrate the Catholic faith in Bougainville. So yes, there were many traditional activities apart from having mass or the faith celebrations. It was complemented with our traditional cultures and dances and all this.
What sort of contribution has the Catholic Church given to the people of Bougainville?
Talking about the contribution by the Catholic Church to the people of Bougainville, the Church has contributed a lot in terms of social services, especially with education, health, and also food. Like when the missionaries came, they brought in with them three things. So one is they brought the schools, our education. The second is health, is the hospitals or health centers. And of course, food, where we have the missions, the establishment of the missions. So to ask what the Catholic Church has contributed to Bougainville, I will say that it has contributed a lot in the face of Bougainville today. It's very much because of the church's influence and contribution in terms of faith and the three main social services that I've mentioned, education, health, and establishment of the missions that came with other services as well.
Raymond, we all know that the people of Bougainville suffered a lot during the crisis. It was a situation that both people in PNG and Bougainville went through. But how was the church to the people of Bougainville during the crisis?
During the peak of the crisis, the people took ownership of the faith. And that was also the start of the church at family level being strengthened at that time. So during the time where there were no services, there was this fighting and all this fear going on. And the faith of the people was, it was brought to another level by people. They took ownership, took responsibility of, and they maintained this faith at the family level. They were able to stay together in small groups and pray every day, asking God for protection and all this. So one way, church was present during that time and was reflected basically by people taking ownership and also by putting into practice and putting into life this responsibility of the church at the family level as domestic church. So this is what actually happened here in Bougainville during the crisis period.
The women have always been leaders in the community during that crisis, and this preparation of the 125 years of the church in Bougainville, tell us about that.
For the women too, especially for the mothers in Bougainville, they also contributed, and I think this led from that taking ownership and for the domestic church at the family level. I think it somehow also contributed to this longing and call for peace. And the women were the first ones to come out and negotiate peace in Bougainville. they saw the need. They didn't want any more violence and all this. So they took responsibility and the way out, way forward, by standing up and calling their sons and calling their brothers, their husbands, to come out so that peace could be negotiated. And yeah, this is what the women of Bougainville did, and they are credited for this, and we all know that. Like recently during these celebrations, we also had our women, we had our mothers. They were also again on the front line with preparations. Like they again took the lead again to ensure that these 125 years Jubilee celebrations was a success, and we had a very peaceful, joyous, and happy celebrations.
And that is Raymond Garana, the Media and Communications Officer with the Bougainville Women's Federation, and he was speaking there with Caroline Terriman.
Pacific Beat.
All right, welcome back to Pacific Beat. Malo te mai bongbongini. I'm your host, Agito Bol. Just giving a quick recap of what's been on the show so far. Fiji's Prime Minister announcing plans to appeal the High Court's damning critique of the inquiry set up to investigate the head of the country's anti-corruption watchdog. Also in PNG, another foreign officer has taken up a senior leadership role in the police force, this time from Tonga. Still to come, American Samoa shocks everyone at the Men's Flag Football World Championship, ending America's 14-year victory streak. But right now, it's time for your news wrap.
Hold the front page!
Yes, Manuel Xanya, welcome back to Pacific Beat. It is that time we head around the region to get the latest headlines from across the region. That's brought to you by our producer, Dana Kirimoff, who was in the studio with me this morning. Good morning.
Good morning, Aggie. How are you?
Oh, it's been a bit of a funny morning, isn't it?
Yes, yeah. Good morning. Funny yes. And good.
Yes. Behind the scenes, we have a great time here, guys.
Yes.
But right now, we are heading around the region to get some stories that you've brought to us. This morning, though, this looks like there's a number of Pacific countries that have joined the United States in criticizing China after their recent nuclear-capable missile tests in the Pacific. This has been going on for a while, though,
hasn't it? This has been going on for a while. So a statement released by the US government sort of indirectly claimed that China did not give the world the mandatory 24-hour notice before launching a dummy warhead into the South Pacific, as reported by RNZ. Now, the statement had four Pacific Islands Forum country signatories, that being New Zealand, Australia, the Marshall Islands, and Palau.
Okay, but I know that this comes after a failed meeting between the Pacific Island Forum leaders to release a joint statement in reaction to the test, right?
Yes, yeah. So that happened before they came together in trying to respond to it, but they couldn't agree on the actual statement. So this statement coming out and those four signatories really indicates how strong the dividing lines are on this issue. But given that it's understood that Nauru and Kiribati were the nations that stood in the way of that consensus for the PIF reaction, I think it's interesting that only four out of the PIF members signed on to the US's letter. But PIF Secretary General Baron Wanga said that the statement that didn't go through was a case of just finding the right formatting and that they were committed to getting there in the end. So maybe the other nations are just waiting to be able to put their names to that instead of jumping on to the US reaction.
Right. Thank you for that. Okay. We're heading to bird flu.
Yeah.
Being at the Pacific's doorstep, I know we had a story on this recently, but it now appears that Pacific governments have asked New Zealand for advice on actually handling the H5 avian influenza. What's happening here?
Yes. So the bird flu, as far as we're aware, still has not reached the Pacific, but the New Zealand Ministry of Primary and Industries Chief Veterinary Officer has confirmed that information has been shared with six Pacific countries following questions from RNZ Pacific. Now, this information was shared after requests were received for information and advice relating to preparedness, surveillance, testing, wildlife management, and outbreak response.
Okay, nice. Well, you know, there's always that saying, right? Prevention is better than trying to find a cure afterwards. Okay, finally to sport, where Fiji has officially joined the Pacific Rugby League Partnership.
Yeah, so Fiji joins Papua New Guinea, Samoa and Tonga, as reported by the Border Mail. The $250 million partnership was launched in July, and funding will go towards grassroots competitions in the Pacific, establishing school rugby league programs and expanding the existing violence prevention and youth programs.
Okay, nice.
The partnership will also facilitate both NRL and NRLW games to be played in the Pacific.
What's interesting, though, I'm wondering, is the $250 million figure, is that actually being provided by the Australian government?
Yes. So that amount is part of a bigger $600 million commitment, which includes support for the entry of the PNG Chiefs into the NRL in 2028. Now, the Australian Rugby League Commission boss, Peter Beattie, was in Suva yesterday to see Fiji Prime Minister Sitiveni Rambuka and the Sports Minister Jesse Sakuru formally sign a statement of intent into Parliament. Now, Beattie told reporters in Suva that the ARLC would work with the Fiji government and the local community and schools to actually deliver the programs, not just fund them.
Nice. All right. Look, as always, Dana, really appreciate you coming through with those headlines for our news wrap here on Pacific Beat.
You're listening to Pacific Beat on ABC Radio Australia.
Now, West Papua's decades-long campaign for self-determination shifted to Canberra this week for the first meeting of the Australian chapter of the International Parliamentarians for West Papua. The IPWP was set up in 2008 to promote awareness about West Papua's struggle against Indonesia for independence. Exiled West Papuan leader Benny Wender set up the body, and he was in Canberra this week for its first meeting on Australian soil. He says Australia has a critical role to play in West Papua's path to independence.
Australia is a big country and big power in the region, so the moral obligation to support West Papua because, of course, Australia talk about the humanitarian crisis in Middle East or other part of the world, but this is just 200 kilometers from the north of Australia, from Queensland, and this is a human rights crisis happening, internal displacement, almost 124,931 West Papua displaced since 2018 up to now.
Yesterday's International Parliamentarians for West Papua meeting was convened by Greens Party politician, Senator David Shoebridge, who is joining us on the line from Canberra. With that, I say good morning, Senator, and welcome to Pacific Beat.
Yeah, good morning and good to be speaking.
Yeah, thank you for joining us this morning. I must say, how was the turnout for this first meeting of really the Australian chapter of the International Parliamentarians for West Papua?
Well, we had politicians from obviously my party, the Greens Party. We had and also political representation from both the coalition and the government. But fundamentally, we wanted to be there to hear from West Papuans about what was happening on the ground and what Australia could do in terms of solidarity. And we had Benny Wender, of course, who travelled across to come and sort of lead the delegation. But we had West Papuans who are living, many of them living in exile here from across Australia. And what they had to tell us about what was happening on the ground was genuinely shocking and should be a call for action for Australian politicians.
Yeah. And so with that, Senator, what was the key outcome from yesterday's gathering?
Well, the key outcome was a unanimous call from the West Papuan delegation and also student supporters that they had who came with them from the University of Wollongong for Australia to support the resolution of 2019, which was driven by the Pacific and supported by more than 100 countries, for Indonesia to allow the UN High Commissioner for Human Rights to enter West Papua and undertake a fact-finding mission about what was happening on the ground. This is something Australia supported in 2019, but we've had almost radio silence from the government in the years since. And you know, this should be something that Australia, as a friend of Indonesia, can raise clearly. And it's not just Australia. As I said, more than 100 countries have supported that as a critical step forward in supporting the rights of West Papuans.
But so for you yourself, when you see Australia, they have very close relations with Indonesia. Again, what are you hoping the IPWP will or can do, you know, to really push the West Papua's cause further?
Well, I think one of the most important things we can do is actually talk about West Papua. West Papua is barely 250 kilometres from Australia. You know, I travel a bigger distance from my home in Sydney to when I drive to come to Parliament in Canberra than is the distance between Australia and West Papua, one of our closest neighbours. And it is never mentioned or almost never mentioned in the Australian Parliament, even though there are such significant human rights issues occurring in West Papua. And I think one of the most important things we did in hosting the delegation, speaking with Benny Wender, speaking with the West Papuans from across Australia, was speak truth about this in the Australian Federal Parliament, because in largely due to the impact that people perceive it having on our relationship with Indonesia, there is a collective silence on the human rights issues happening in West Papua. It's deforestation, it's dehousing, it's the impact of the military operations. And thank goodness we finally spoke about some of that in the Federal Parliament.
Mm. When we talk about international pressure, right, I feel like it's done very little over the past decades. Again, what do you think this group can do differently?
Well, we need to learn from decades of silence, and we need to learn strategies so that the Australian public in particular can place pressure on their government, and I'm in the Parliament, place pressure on the government here to actually take some action. It is possible for Australia to do this. We have close ties with Indonesia. Those ties are increasingly economic. There are structural government-to-government ties. There are military ties with Indonesia. There has previously been significant pressure in Australia about those military ties and to ensure that they're not furthering displacement and violence in West Papua. And I know the Australian people, when they hear this, they support the call for the rights of West Papuans to be respected. But if no politician speaks about it, if there's a conspiracy of silence in Canberra, the Australian public won't hear that call.
Well, Senator, let's talk about some of the incidences, though, that have happened across West Papua. You know, in recent months, there's been highly publicised events of civilians being executed by separatist fighters. I know it includes the case of that American pilot and, more recently, Papuan locals as well. I mean, are you worried that these incidences may deter public support for that independence movement?
Well, of course, I'm a Greens politician. I am committed to political change through peace and non-violence, and that's the pathway that we see delivering respect and rights for the struggle in West Papua. Yeah, and again, I suppose this highlights just how skewed the political discussion here is in Australia. Those incidents of violence are of deep, deep concern to myself as a Greens politician. But, you know, the public debate in Australia does not hear about the Indonesian military's appearances. It doesn't hear about the helicopters landing in remote villages. It's not getting the report of some of the widespread violence that's been delivered by the Indonesian military against West Papuans. And that skewed political, that skewed reporting of what's happening in West Papua is one of the things that I think, as a politician who believes in truth and justice, we need to fight against. And we had some of that fighting against it yesterday. We had West Papuans talk about the military helicopters landing in their village, people running into the jungle, significant arrests, displacement. But also, you know, we also heard reports of the widespread deforestation that's happening, people's traditional lands being despoiled. And then there are programs afoot to clear some 1.2 million hectares of virgin forest in West Papua, which is, I think, effectively ecocide. And so, yes, of course I'm concerned about these isolated instances of violence that are happening in the resistance. And But the scale of the violence that's happening, the state-sponsored violence against West Papuans, should be the front and centre issue.
Which brings me to the fact that, you know, Australia signed an upgraded security treaty with Indonesia, you know, at the start of the year. Do you then think these type of arrangements makes West Papua an issue about security rather than human rights?
Well, yes, I am concerned that increasingly Australia's relationship with our region, with the Pacific, with Southeast Asia, is being securitized. And it's not just Indonesia. It's a series of pacts that have been signed with our Pacific neighbours. where the primary focus of the relationship from Australia's perspective isn't addressing climate change. It's not people-to-people contacts. It's not investment in each country for climate resilience. It's not education. Increasingly, it's security. And in my view, that is a misfocus from Australia. Our relationship with our neighbours should be built on far deeper and far more fundamental connections. Mm. Human rights, respect for democracy, engagement to deal with the climate crisis that is front and centre in the Pacific. But instead, we have a government here in Australia, and it's, you know, this Labor government, which seems to want to securitise all of our relationships. And I don't think that's in the long-term interests of the Pacific or Australia.
Yeah, because I think it really is a matter of trust, right? Like because I'm sure we can see historically distrust has actually run quite deep. And I say this because does this security treaty not then signify the responsibility that Australia and Indonesia carry in terms of that regional stability?
Well, I do think a positive relationship between Australia and Indonesia, and hopefully an equal relationship between the two countries, is important for stability. But the relationship needs to be one based much more on people-to-people connections and much more on shared values than simply being securitized. And, you know, often our Pacific friends and neighbours see Australia through the lens of our relationship with the United States and through that, our relationship with China. And I understand why our Pacific friends are very suspicious of that, because when I meet with delegations from the Pacific, their primary concern isn't a security threat from China. Their primary concern is in having peace in the Pacific and dealing with the existential threat of climate change. And I understand why Australia wanting to securitize all of our relationships creates suspicion. And I also understand how the Pacific often see us as not having a genuinely independent foreign policy, but rather being driven by the priorities of Washington.
Mm. Definitely a conversation that still needs to be had, Senator. A lot to still unpack, but that is all the time we have for this morning. I just want to say thank you so much for coming on the show and sharing.
Yeah, a pleasure speaking, and thank you for keeping the Pacific front and centre in the debate. It's our region, it's our future, and I think Australia has an obligation to engage more broadly with a sense of sort of mutual benefit than we have in the past.
Absolutely. Well, thank you very much again, Senator, for joining us. That is Greens Party Senator David Shoebridge, convener of the Australian chapter of the International Parliamentarians for West Papua. Now to sport. The team from American Samoa have pulled off one of the biggest sporting shocks of recent times at the Men's Flag Football World Championship in the German city of Dusseldorf. For the uninitiated, flag football is a small-scale version of American football without the tackling. And unsurprisingly, the United States have dominated, winning 6 world titles in a row without ever losing a match. That was until they came up against American Samoa. The team from Oceania eventually finished a 5th overall, just missing out on a place at the Los Angeles Olympics, but only after they had ended the Americans' 14-year unbeaten run. Ethan Lake, a driving force behind the American Samoa team and Secretary General of the U.S. Territory's National Olympic Committee, was in Dusseldorf to witness the drama.
We were shocked, too. We had no idea. I had to actually go after when people were telling me that. I said, are you sure? I'm like, maybe it was the last 14 games. 14 years. You know, we looked it up, and sure enough, it was true. And we had no idea. And I think that was probably good that we didn't know, because that might have made it a little harder for us.
So you win against Australia, you win against the United States, and then lose against Israel. For people who are not familiar with flag football, that would also seem to be a slightly curious result. Was that just a case of the players were still on a high from the previous game?
When we played the U.S., it was like playing the Super Bowl. And now imagine a Super Bowl team having to play another game later that day. That high does not just go away. So now you're having that high of celebration inside of you, even though we try to calm them down and everything else. And they did. But it's still there. That adrenaline after the game goes on. right? And then we're not sure why it didn't happen. It definitely was not our best game. Things just didn't click.
Tell me about the team. Where have the players been recruited from?
Our players are all Samoan. They're from all over, from around the states in California, Florida, Alabama, and American Samoa. So it was a mixture. We did a lot of just scouting and getting all of our Islanders out there and working on them. And literally a year ago, we didn't have a 5-on-5 flag football team.
So with what you could characterize as extraordinary success, therefore, in a very short period of time, where does the team go next? Is there still a chance that you could feature in the Olympics?
You know, it wasn't if we're going to be in the Olympics or qualify for the Olympics. For us, it was when. If we had done it this time, which we just missed it, then we would have the next 2 years for preparation. Now we have to go the longer route, which is unfortunate. Next year, there'll be continental qualifiers, right? So we'll have to go to that and get the top two. It is my understanding, just if you're not aware, is Australia will be hosting the Oceania. That's what the plan is they'll host the Oceania Championships. You know, after we beat the USA, we were inundated by so many other countries congratulating us and thanking us because it inspired them.
What's been the reaction in American Samoa? Because, I mean, for the people of the islands, this must be huge. It's one of the biggest sporting events that's ever happened to American Samoa.
Yeah, we've had so many good messages back from home from those who know. But you say you took fifth. If people aren't in it, they don't always know what that means, right? There's going to be a lot of people back home trying to get an understanding, right? They're going, oh, yeah, you took fifth. You didn't take first. You know, no big deal. I think there's going to be a lot of that, or they don't really understand the impact and what fifth in the world means, going from a year ago being not even ranked to 33rd a year ago, October, and then in the tournament itself, jumping all the way to fifth best in the world. Think about it. We're the fifth best, and only because we lost to Canada.
If you want to explain things to people back in American Samoa, if you tell them, well, look, we just beat Australia, Germany on their home patch, Japan, and oh, by the way, the Americans for the first time in 14 years, you'd think it might sink in then.
Anybody who follows football would know. It's just the ones who don't. And then we still got those who don't understand it, you know, to what level. They think, oh, you're Oceania, or you played a game, right? I think it'll sink in. When we get back, I'll be the first one back. The rest are, you know, slowly coming back, and we're going to work on that. But I've been doing a lot of work trying to help build up Oceania, because before there was only Australia, New Zealand, and us. And I wanted to increase it, so I can say that hopefully by next year, Samoa is registered now, Western Samoa, so they should have a team, both men's and women's. I invited the Tongan president for their federation, so he was there witnessing the whole thing, and his name is Levi Sawaki, so he's put all his paperwork in. And they're no strangers, because they have players that are in the U.S. as well. So these countries are going to, you know, make some waves as well, hopefully. I will see. And then Fiji. Fiji has been working on trying to get a team as well. When you take a look at this, beating the United States was huge. We're the smallest country that was in there. We're 47,000 population in the country itself. Of course, we have Samoans outside. That's why we recruit all around. There's less than 800,000 Samoans total in the world. The next level up on population was Panama, over 4 million. The fact that we're such a small nation to be able to do what we did, to me, is amazing. The other thing is, I'm pretty sure that we were the only country of the 16 there that didn't have a sign sponsor. We need to get these in the schools. We don't have the funding that these other countries have. We can't do this without the sponsorships. Plant the little seed with us, and we're going to show you what a little country of 47,000 can do in the world. You haven't seen nothing yet. You give us the resources, and you're going to see a transformation like you've never seen before. That's what I want to say to the world.
And that there is Ethan Lake, Secretary General of American Samoa's National Olympic Committee, on the line from a stopover in Seattle en route to home after a memorable trip to Germany. And he was speaking to Richard Hewitt. Pacific Beat. And that brings us to the end of Pacific Beat. Time to take a look back at some of our main stories today. Vanuatu's Prime Minister says his government will set up an advisory committee for the President on his constitutional power of mercy after inmates convicted of sexually abusing children received presidential pardons.
I think the office of the head of state is sort of exposed in the sense that has no recourse to lean back on an organisation.
Also, the inaugural meeting of the Australian chapter of the International Parliamentarians for West Papua was held in Canberra this week.
Yes, I am concerned that increasingly Australia's relationship with our region with the Pacific, with Southeast Asia, is being securitized.
Now, remember, you can find our stories when you type Pacific Beat or Radio Australia into your search engine, but our team will be back at the same time tomorrow at 6 a.m. PNG time. But you can hear us again this afternoon at 5 p.m. PNG time. Stay tuned to ABC Radio Australia, though, because your news is next, and coming up after that, it's Nisha Daily. Until next time, o toa o whaato, this is Pacific Beat, yours in the Pacific.